G-Force, a kaiju podcast.
G-Force?
Well, it's big and terrible. More frightening than I ever thought possible.
Kiss you, guys.
What terrible language!
Calling Monster Island. Calling Monster Island.
And now, your hosts.
One is me. And the other is Godzilla.
Nick and Andrew.
Hello and welcome to episode 33 of G-Force, a kaiju podcast, a show in which a rotating cast of kaiju enthusiasts gets together every other week to discuss all things kaiju. My name is Nick, and with me, I actually don't have my co-host Andrew because he felt that he didn't really have much to say about this movie that couldn't be summed up in a pre-recorded message, which is exactly what you'll be hearing from him later. But with me, I have...
Hey, this is Evan.
This is United Nations reporter Brendan Sheehan, reporting in from Massachusetts. A recent series of earthquakes in Chile has devastated the country, resulting in the UN giving... Hold on, sorry, wrong transcript. Hi, yes, this is Brendan.
And today we're discussing 1962's King Kong vs. Godzilla, directed by Ishiro Honda, with a screenplay by Shinichi Sekizawa. And since Andrew's not here, I will give a brief synopsis. Frustrated over low ratings of a series sponsored by Pacific Pharmaceuticals, Mr. Taco, director of the company's advertising department, sends two of his employees, Osamu Sakurai and Kinsaburo Furue, to Faro Island after catching wind of a giant monster residing there that he believes could boost ratings. After arriving on the island, Sakurai and Furue meet the native people, who the two men sway into allowing them to stay by giving them a transistor radio and cigarettes. Soon after, thunder and lightning herald the arrival of Faro Island's giant monster god. While investigating the cause of melting icebergs in the Bering Sea, a United Nations nuclear submarine called the Seahawk comes across an iceberg with a mysterious blue glow emanating from the inside. But as they get closer, the vessel begins to fail, and it is soon destroyed by the source of the mysterious glow, Godzilla, who escapes from the icy prison he was buried in 7 years earlier and travels to a nearby military base that he quickly lays to waste. Because of this, Godzilla dominates the press, infuriating Mr. Taco because it benefits the competition of Pacific Pharmaceuticals. Meanwhile, on Faro Island, a giant octopus begins to terrorize a village, but is soon stopped by the island god, King Kong, who quickly dispatches the sea creature. Afterwards, the gigantic ape helps himself to some red berry juice, which, along with a dance performed by the natives, puts the beast to sleep. Upon seeing this, Sakurai decides they should put Kong on a gigantic raft to take him to Japan. With King Kong overtaking Godzilla in the press, Taco is overjoyed and decides to go see him in person. Soon after he arrives on the ship transporting Kong, the beast begins to awaken, prompting Sakurai and Furue to detonate the dynamite on the raft. But when the detonator fails, they resort to shooting at the dynamite with their rifles. However, King Kong survives the explosion and heads to Japan himself, where Godzilla is now wreaking havoc. Soon after, King Kong and Godzilla meet for the first time, but Godzilla quickly scares the ape off with his atomic breath. Godzilla continues to devastate Japan and avoid defeat at the hands of the Japanese self-defense forces, while his counterpart partakes in classic King Kong shenanigans, climbing a landmark while holding a woman in his hand. In this case, the National Diet Building and Sakurai's sister, Fumiko. With Sakurai playing the rhythm of the native dance on the drums and the self-defense forces firing capsules full of red berry juice at Kong, they're able to put him to sleep and rescue Fumiko. Kong is soon transported by the self-defense forces to Godzilla's location on Mount Fuji, where the two legendary monsters collide. Godzilla eventually knocks Kong out cold, but the gigantic ape is soon revived and empowered by lightning. Now with the upper hand, the newly electrified King Kong is able to put Godzilla on the defensive until the two fall into the ocean together. As King Kong resurfaces and begins swimming home, Mr. Taco finally gives up and lets him return to Faro Island in peace. So what do you guys think of this movie?
This is hands down one of my absolute favorite Godzilla movies. It's one I have a very, very strong nostalgic attachment to. I got a VHS copy of it for my 9th birthday. So I got that and The Wolfman for my 9th birthday. And those were the first VHS, commercial VHS tapes we ever had that were mine, not my father's that I also watched or something. It had a real... It has a real significance to me that for that reason, but then also just it's a fantastic movie, especially obviously in its Japanese cut. And I just want to remind anyone listening right at the top who picked up the Criterion set, in case you haven't really gone through and confirmed this, The Japanese cut of the movie is in that set. It's just on the special features disc. Anyway, no. Brilliant movie, easily in my top five Godzilla movies, possibly like the number two spot after the original. I don't know. Those kind of distinctions don't really matter much to me, but love it, love it, love it.
Yeah, I kind of got to agree. This is also one of my favorite Godzilla movies. I wouldn't say top five. I definitely say it's up there, though I can't really say at the moment where exactly it is in my placing. But yeah, I love so much about it. I love the script. I love the characters. I love the action. It's a great film. It's had a very complicated history with it, though, because I will be honest, when I first watched the US cut, it was by far my least favorite Godzilla movie, because while I've grown to love the US cut, I'm still not a big fan of it. But when I did get the chance to watch the Japanese cut through both Criterion and our good friend Andrew, I will say it quickly grew on me, because it's really just a tour de force. It's like, there's a reason this is one of the most popular Godzilla movies of all time. It has like everything working 100% full cylinders. It's got Honda, it's got Tsuburaya, it's got Nakajima, it's got Kenji Sahara. It's everything. It's a fantastic film, really.
Though sadly, in the US version, Kenji Sahara is listed in the credits as Keiji Sahaka. And of course, Honda, as is so often the case, is mistransliterated as Inoshiro, but Keiji Sahaka was the one that really jumped out at me.
I completely forgot about Keiji Sahaka. Oh my god, I totally remember that. I was literally like, I know that guy. Why can't I find Keiji Sahaka on Google? Oh my god, that makes... Oh, dude, you just opened up some ancient, ancient memories.
I absolutely love this movie. The first time I saw it was like, honestly, only like 2 years ago. It was kind of the last pre-existing Godzilla movie that I hadn't seen. So finally getting to see that a couple years ago was really, really great. And I instantly fell in love with it. It's definitely one of my favorite Godzilla movies and easily one of my favorite King Kong movies. So yeah, I just absolutely love it. So let's move into our human characters here.
I'm sick of Godzilla. Send a wire. Immediately.
Oh, yes. Right away, sir.
I want my own monster. Find me a monster, fast.
That's exactly 10 words, sir.
Send it.
Evan, would you like to read the cast list?
I would love to read the cast list. Let's see. So the film stars Tadao Takashima as Osamu Sakurai, a television camera operator. Kenji Sahara as Kazuo Fujita, some sort of an inventor. Yu Fujiki as Kensaburo Furue, a sound man who works for the same television station as Sakurai. Ichiro Arashima as Mr. Taco, the Pacific Pharmaceuticals marketing head. Miyahama as Fumiko Sakurai, sister of Takashima's character and fiance of Fujita. Jun Tazaki as General Shinzo, Akiko Wakabayashi as Tamie, the neighbor of Sakurai and Fujita, and Akihiko Hirata as Dr. Shigesawa.
So this movie has one of my favorite human characters in any Godzilla movie and any King Kong movies, Mr. Taco. He's just great and hilarious, and Ichiro Arashima absolutely kills it. He's honestly just such a hilarious actor, and I just love watching him in this movie. A scene in this movie that James really loves, and he wanted us to bring up because he couldn't be here tonight, is the scene where Mr. Taco, Sakurai, and Furue are all in a car driving straight through the military checkpoint because they're just, you know, so self-important that they feel like they can be at a military checkpoint. It's just absolutely hilarious. I see why James loves it so much. It's not really one I have ever really paid attention to, but this time around I actually did take note of it. And yeah, it's just completely hilarious. They're just speeding straight through that thing because they deep down they know that they are not supposed to be there.
Yes, that is a great scene for everybody. I think my favorite moment of Taco's, there are a couple that I really like when they're on the ship. But after the raft has blown up, when King Kong emerges from the water and everybody else is reacting kind of shocked and horrified. You know, this is a big, dangerous monster that is now loose in Japanese waters. There's a moment where Taco looks really like impressed and proud of Kong.
And he carries that throughout the rest of the movie. And I love that so much. Like, I really love whenever he's like arguing with that complete stranger later on in the movie, just trying to like really get across that King Kong is more powerful than that guy thinks he is. And I think it's so great.
Yes, they practically come to blows over it.
Yeah.
I love that scene so much.
And honestly, I think like after a certain point, it like kind of almost seems like he has an emotional attachment to King Kong, like specifically whenever one of the like military guys says something about like hopefully King Kong and Godzilla will share the same fate or something. And just the thought of King Kong dying clearly just genuinely saddens him. And I think that's kind of an interesting touch.
I have to agree. Taco is, I'm going to drop a real spicy hot take here. Taco is probably my favorite version in all the Kong films of the denim archetype. He's just so lovable. I love his enthusiasm. I love his like sheer fanboy adoration. I love how, well, Charles Grodin gets close in the 76 film. I love how he like goes so overboard with the corporate greed angle that it come loops back around to being like realistic again. I can't praise the character enough. One of the top five characters in the Godzilla series for me, at least.
Yeah, he's definitely at least like my second favorite of the denim archetypes. Either him or like Jack Black's Carl Denham. But yeah, he's just so funny, man. Like, I just like the look of boredom on his face at like the beginning of the film when he's watching the, I think it's called Wonderful World series or something like that. It's just, he sells it so well. And I really love the phone gag whenever like his boss calls and he doesn't realize it's his boss and he's like yelling at him. And then his boss, like he realizes it's his boss who starts yelling at him instead. And then he starts bowing at the phone. It's so good.
No, and I love how well he sells that bit of physical comedy when they stop him from accidentally putting his weight on the plunger to blow up the raft. And then everybody calms down and he so casually just reaches up and starts to put his hand on it again. And it's so perfectly played. And then it just kind of does this little like, oh, whoops, that would have been a mistake reaction.
It's so good. And like just if when he first takes his hand off of it, he has to like pry his fingers off of it. It's really good. I also really love before that, a little bit after he first arrives on the boat and they're like down below the deck or whatever. I don't know boat terms. And he's looking out the window at Kong and he's waving to him. He's just going, hello, hello. And then he blows kisses at him. It's just one of my favorite little moments in the movie.
My favorite bit on this recent rewatch is just him stepping in for a second into like, I think it's another office. While the rest of the workers are running around, are like talking about Godzilla and Kong, and he just comes back out completely dressed in the whole safari outfit, like in no time. It's just like such a classic bit of comedy, and I adored it.
There's a quote from Ishiro Honda about this movie, and from a Toho special effects encyclopedia book, translated in Steve Reifel and Ed Godzyszewski's Ishiro Honda biography. But in describing this movie, what Honda said was, rather than a straight comedy, my point was that there was this one guy in the advertising section. He tried to do the best job he could, but because of the company's orders, whatever he tried to do became a joke. That's the kind of satire I wanted. The person himself is serious, but the harder he tries, the funnier it gets.
Yeah, that's basically Taco.
That quote also ties directly into my sort of overall take on this movie as a work essentially of very self-conscious self-satire. Well, obviously the movie is satirizing a lot of things about contemporary Japanese television and advertising and commercialism quite broadly. There's another quote, actually It's on the same page in that Honda biography, although not the two quotes aren't paired up together. And it's also from that same Encyclopedia of Godzilla, but talking about this movie and its sort of place in the development of the Godzilla series, Honda said, "To me, what happened was not acceptable. Personally, I didn't want to do it, but the company demanded it. When you have to do it, then you have to do it." Pair that with Honda having said that in his mind, this movie was about a guy who's trying to do the best job he could, but because of the company's orders, whatever he tried to do became a joke. It feels very telling about Honda and Sekizawa's development of this story. The idea that in some way they may see themselves as Taco and, maybe a little bit Sakurai and Furue. That they're having to run around and make King Kong and Godzilla fight each other, which is on the surface a terrible idea because of basically the company demanding something that they can market. I mean, the major difference here being that obviously, in the movie, King Kong and Godzilla fighting did not work out well for anyone, whereas in real life, it worked out wonderfully because despite their reservations, or in a sense because of their reservations, they made a fantastic movie.
Very true. But yeah, that's a lot like how Carl Denham and Jack Driscoll were apparently, so I've heard, like inserts for Marion C. Cooper and Ernest B. Shodzak.
Yeah, no, this is kind of a tradition of with King Kong movies in a sense. But both this and the original King Kong are very meta movies. They're both movies that quite actively comment on their own production.
I can kind of see that in all the Kong films. Black Denham's kind of a take on, could kind of be seen as like a character of Jackson. 76 and Kong Skull Island also have some very meta elements. They're very meta about like this overall idea, like how Kong Skull Island's kind of always like, we're really not going to talk about the giant monsters and stuff. And there's something in 76 right now, it's escaping me. What?
76 is a very, very funny, very broadly satirical movie that I think a lot of people don't entirely get. But that's a conversation for another podcast.
But yeah, in comparison to the original, I have to give it to them for this film for being self-aware and not being like, yeah, we're totally super cool action heroes who are doing nothing wrong in bringing Kong to the mainland. It's fine. So let's talk about some of our other characters here. What do you guys think of our two leads, Sakurai and Furue?
I love Sakurai and Furue. Takashima and Fujiki worked together as a comedy pair in a number of Salaryman movies before they made this. And they based a lot of their rapport on Bing Crosby and Bob Hope in the Road movies, which I'm sure all you kids listening today are massive fans of. I was going to say, it's kind of weird that as an American, I was familiar with King Kong versus Godzilla so long before I was familiar with the Road movies. But I don't know that really is all that surprising in anyone born, say, after 1940. I think they work together extremely well. Takashima is a very, very charismatic lead. I think it's a shame that he didn't get to do more comedy in the Godzilla series. His subsequent Godzilla roles, one of them is a more serious role and the other is just a little cameo. And Yu Fujiki is really, really funny here, as he would be in the next year's No, as he would be 2 years later in Mothra versus Godzilla. But I think Fujiki and Takashima really are at their best and their funniest when they're working together. And I think they have lots and lots of great little comedic beats with each other in this movie.
I was going to say, I always got a major Abbott and Costello vibe from them. And now that I didn't know that whole thing that they were like the stars of their own Salaryman comedy, that actually explains a lot. But yeah, I think they are a fantastic pair. I honestly was going to say, while I do see it for Taco, I kind of see them as more the stand-ins for Honda and Sekizawa, because they're kind of like the ones who are like just tasked to do this thing. They're just kind of like, all right, I guess we're doing this. Like, I don't know. I just really like them a lot. They're just a very good classic comedy duo. And I really love that they just kind of, like, accept that they're just going to go grab this giant monster and bring it to Japan to sell more drugs.
Yeah, my first thought was that maybe Taco was actually supposed to be sort of a stand-in for Tomoyuki Tanaka, but I don't necessarily think the characters break down one-to-one to that degree. But I do wonder if Sekizawa, who was working in advertising at the time, may have associated a little bit with the kind of slick, witty Sakurai. In which case, was Honda the good company man, Furue? I don't really think that Honda and Furue are much alike as characters from what I know of Honda, although we don't know exactly what Sekizawa's perspective was.
Yeah, I like these two characters a lot. For some reason, I can never, ever remember their names. And the only reason I remembered their names this time was because they're written down. But yeah, I think they're very entertaining when they're on screen together. And particularly my favorite moment with them is whenever the natives start like bowing down, whenever the lightning starts striking and they're like, oh, they think the thunder is their god. How silly or whatever. And then they hear Kong's actual roar and then they both start shaking super hard and bowing. It's really great.
I can't believe that they cut that scene out of the Champion Festival version of this movie. For those who don't know, a lot of Toho's earlier special effects films were re-released in the 70s, starting with this one, as part of these children's film festivals. So the movies had to be substantially cut down. King Kong vs. Godzilla lost about 25 minutes, including some really good comedy bits with Taco and with Sakurai and Furue, including the bit where they first hear Kong's roar, which is a pretty important scene. I mean, it establishes that Kong is a real thing for the audience. It starts to establish his relationship with electricity, you know, with thunder and lightning. And it's really funny. I feel like the kids would have really loved it.
Yeah, it's a shame that was cut from that version of the film. For all the reasons you mentioned, it's just a great little moment.
Yeah, I was going to say that is a disappointment. I feel like the idea of the Champion Festival is just like, hey, we're going to take these classic films and let kids see them and get them hooked on the character. It was a good idea, but I feel like the execution was kind of meh. It was just like everything else in the 70s Godzilla era. It was both a hit and a miss.
The really unfortunate thing in this case is that they actually apparently chopped up the movie's negative to prepare the Champion Festival version. So for a long time, the Japanese prints of this movie that were available, anything that was included in the Champion Festival looked really good, and all the additional scenes edited back in were of much, much lower quality. Eventually, they did manage to recover a full print of the movie looking, you know, substantially better. Boy, that new 4K edition is a thing of real beauty. But for a long time, large portions of this movie just looked like garbage because they had mangled it for the Champion Festival.
I have a thing I want to talk about the natives, but I can't remember what I was going to say about them.
I am conflicted on the Faroe Islanders. I will agree there is a tiny bit of discomfort in the blackface used to present them, but I appreciate how, like many natives in these classic 60s Toho films, they are presented as being sensible, good-hearted, and overall being right. Like, they're not wrong about the monster. They know what's going on. They know more than the more enlightened visitors do, and they're in a way, they're myths about Kong being the lightning god and it coming true in the end to save him. And I also just kind of like how they're shown as like very real people. I kind of love in a dark way how they're like instantly manipulated into accepting the wills of Pacific pharmaceutical representatives. And overall, I think my favorite is, I don't know if it's intentional, but I love how stuff like the dancers dancing to lull Kong to sleep and them working on making the berry juice. They just seem kind of bored. I love this idea that, like, to parody the original King Kong, they're just kind of, like, sick of being on the island and dealing with him and all the other monsters. Like,
great, Kong beat another friggin' monster. Got to do a stupid dance again. I should have went to Infant Island with my cousin when I could.
See, yada, yada, ta-take, yada, yada, and so forth, and so forth.
Really should have gone to Odo or maybe wherever Varen is.
Odo Island's a bad idea.
Well, they stopped giving him fish, and then things went wrong.
Give a monster a fish, he'll leave you alone for a day. Teach a monster to fish, he'll leave you alone for your lifetime.
Give a monster a lot of fish, you have a bad reboot.
Good point.
But yeah, that's my thoughts on the Faroe Islanders.
I don't feel qualified to particularly comment on the state of Japanese Polynesian cultural relations in 1962. You know, so I don't view this as harshly as I view similar things coming from American popular culture, mostly because I don't have the cultural context to know how to read this coming from a Japanese filmmaker.
For me, even though, yes, I also don't have the context of this sort of thing either in Japan, to me, I still find it kind of uncomfortable. I don't really enjoy particularly the first scene with the natives. I kind of feel like, even aside from the use of the brown face and everything, I still find just the way they're portrayed to be kind of buffoonish and like caricatures, sort of. So I'm not super into that scene. I find it kind of hard to watch a little bit, but I am kind of conflicted on that scene because I feel like it's trying to say something about the way people from industrialized parts of the world will come into parts of the world where there are indigenous people and will just be like, hey, here's our stuff that you totally don't need, and we'll push that on them, like the cigarettes and the radio, but especially the cigarettes. And so that kind of makes me feel a little better about the scene, but overall I still find it somewhat uncomfortable for me personally.
Yeah, I mean, Pacific Pharmaceuticals shows up and takes away their god and in exchange gives them lung cancer and annoying music until the batteries die out.
Yeah, pretty much. Do you guys have anything about the other characters?
I just have a general thought that I really enjoy Fumiko and Fujita. I just think they're nice characters. I don't really have a lot to say. I think they're just very, like, well acted. And I just like them. I don't really have anything more to say. I just think they're good characters. I really love Fujita's, like, very well acted rage at Kong after he grabs Fumiko. And I did know, I kind of feel bad for Fumiko because she ends up being in the path of destruction of both Kong and Godzilla, so the universe must hate her. But yeah, I think they're both good. I do have one last thought, but I'll save it for our closing thoughts on the character.
Yeah, I think Miehama is very good as Fumiko. The character doesn't really have a lot to do besides, you know, run and fall and scream and pout. But she does those things effectively. She's engaging. I think she really works in, like, the scene where you should never let Fumiko Sakurai near a train because it's going to get attacked by a monster. First Godzilla and then Kong. But that first Godzilla attack, when she gets left behind and there's the shot from the back of the truck of the stragglers left behind looking desperate. And then, you know, she's running and she collapses in the water. And, you know, that sequence goes a long way to personalizing the threat that Godzilla represents, and I think Hama is really good there. And yeah, Sahara is just great as Fujita. I love his clowning around with the super strong wire at the beginning, although I can never figure out what it is he is supposed to have that wire attached to when he is out there dangling off the balcony.
Oh my god, it's not just me. It drives me insane.
It looks like It looks like he might be wearing a harness of some kind. I can't tell. There's like a black circle around his shirt, but that might be part of the shirt. And even if it is a harness, it might be a harness that the actor is wearing. I don't know. I can't tell what's supposed to be happening.
It's insane. It's like he's holding on to, like, at first he's like holding on to the friggin'. He's holding out and his hand straight out like he has a harness around the balcony. And they're like, oh, okay. But they start swinging around, grabbing it like Spider-Man. Like, so where the heck is it? Oh, my God. It's the special effects shot that drives me the insane the most in the movie.
And then, Brendan, you also talked about the moment where he's, you know, sort of panicking because Kong has Fumiko, which is a really important moment because it's what gives Sakurai, it makes Sakurai think of the natives, which is what makes him think of the idea of playing the drums and knocking Kong out. Although they cut the part in the American version where Fujita gesticulates, where Fujita's gesticulations remind Sakurai of the native dancing, so that kind of gets lost. But that's a scene where apparently Honda gave Sahara very free rein. Sort of, you know how this person would react in this situation. Just really commit to it, and Sahara really appreciated that. He thought the world of Honda, and it meant a lot to him. Apparently, that Honda was willing to just trust him to play that scene as he wanted to.
That's really cool. It, just in terms of that scene specifically, I really like. I like the way they save Fumiko from Kong. And also I want to point out that something that I personally find very cool is that in this film, one of the leads is a drummer. And in Godzilla vs. Kong, one of the leads is a podcaster. And I am both of those things. And I just think that's cool. And I love that in this film, the day is saved by the power of drums.
Sakurai being able to drum, like that's set up at the beginning of the movie in the Japanese version, is lost in the American cut. So there's no explanation for why at the end, all of a sudden, he's just able to drum.
Boo.
Come on, John Beck. You're better than this.
Clearly, John Beck was not better than this.
He was not better than this, but you can at least be confident when you're doing this. I was also going to say that was my last bit of characters I really loved, especially on this rewatch, how all these little, like, things that you just think are character quirks, like, oh, Fujita's inventor who has a super strong wire. Sakurai is a drummer. All these things that you think are just little quirks end up coming together at the end for when they finally take out and capture Kong. And I think I thought that was a really nice bit of writing. Good job, Sakazawa.
And that actually reminds me of another thing I wanted to bring up when we were talking about the characters in this movie as representatives of members of the crew, that in a way you could look at Sahara's character, at Fujita, in a way you could look at Fujita as the stand-in for Tsuburaya. That, oh my God, we've got to make Kong and Godzilla fight. How are we going to do that? Oh, well, we've got this really inventive guy who's good at using super strong strings. Like, that's a lot of what Tsuburaya's job was. Oh, I also wanted to mention, looping back now, well, talking about the filmmaking aspect, but this is more about Sakurai. Sakurai is a camera operator. Several times throughout the movie, at like key dramatic moments, we see him take out a camera and start shooting. And one unfortunate oversight for me of this movie is that we never see the events from Sakurai's perspective. We never see through his lens.
That would be cool. So in terms of Fumiko and Fujita, I like them a lot. I don't really have much to say about them. But I find their presence endearing. Same with Fumiko's friend, played by Akiko Wakabayashi, whose character's name is escaping me right now.
Tomie. I don't know that it's ever even used in the movie. If it is, certainly not much. So we've talked a lot about the characters on the King Kong side of this movie, but not really that much about the characters on the Godzilla side of the plot. And I mean, there's a kind of a good reason for that, which is that the most interesting and entertaining characters are the ones on the Kong side, and then sort of the ones who cross over between the two, like Fujita and Fumiko. But the characters who are more strictly relegated to the Godzilla side of the narrative, they're kind of filling stock roles. But there are still a couple of real standout actors in there. Jun Tazaki, who plays a lot of great military and government officials in these movies, plays General Shinzo, and he brings his usual gravitas to the proceedings. One of my very favorites, Akihiko Hirata, who was, of course, Dr. Sarazawa in the original Godzilla, shows up here as Dr. Shigazawa, who is honestly mostly kind of an exposition machine, but Hirata is just so charming that you really enjoy listening to him provide exposition. And then lastly, I wanted to mention a character who was completely cut out of the American release of this movie. A little past the 24-minute mark in the Japanese version, we cut to the Shinsei Maru No. 2, the ship that Fujita is on. And the captain of that ship is played by Yoshifumi Tajima, who is another standard, you know, member of this Toho Kaiju stock company, who we see popping up a lot in these movies. And he just has a really sweet little scene here opposite Kenji Sahara. You know, he comes off as a very warm and likable character, and he's very kind in how he talks to Fujita and sort of playful with him about his relationship with Fumiko. It's just a really nice little bit for Tajima, who oftentimes plays military characters, is probably best remembered as the secondary villain in Mothra vs. Godzilla. But here he's just this very gentle, warm, likable person, and I really enjoy his scene. Bummer it's not in the American cut.
Yeah, I wasn't going to say anything about Dr. Shigesawa because I didn't really have much to say about him. But now that you brought him up, I can't not talk about a character played by Akihiko Hirata, who is my favorite actor in the classic Toho stable of actors. So I just really like this character's sort of like calm, these things are going to happen and there's probably nothing we can do about it demeanor. I also think it's interesting to see the next character in the Godzilla series played by Akihiko Hirata now speaking for Godzilla rather than killing him like the previous character, Dr. Sarazawa, did. Speaking of monsters, let's move on to monsters and special effects.
Director of special effects on this movie, as with all of the classic Toho kaiju movies of the era, was Eiji Tsuburaya. And the role of Godzilla was played by Haruo Nakajima. The role of King Kong was played by Shoichi Solomon Hirose.
I'm somewhat conflicted on King Kong in this movie. I like him. I don't like his design or the suit. I can see that there is some charm there. I won't deny that. So I don't hate it. It's not like it comes up on screen and I'm like, oh God, kill it, you know? But it's probably one of my least favorite Kong designs. But that said, I like how he's just kind of this, like, almost just like a giant drunk dude the whole time, and I think that's really funny. The US version of this film says that he is a thinking animal, and I don't believe it. I don't think that this Kong is very smart, but that's okay. That's what I love about him.
Yeah, the puppet that they use for close-ups looks just particularly goofy and dopey all the time. Adorable, I love it. But intelligence is not my immediate association with it. And I like the suit. I mean, it's ratty looking, and when they have the extended arms on it, that's kind of ridiculous. But it has a kind of charm to me. I like the design, I guess, a little more than the execution. And I think it achieved its most perfect realization in the classic Bandai action figure of that suit, which is a thing of absolute beauty and one of the treasures of my collection. And kind of looks like Elvis.
You know what? I can actually see it. I kind of love this Kong. He's a goof, and it's intentional. I kind of love it. I really like how he's kind of like living his own life, getting drunk. He ends up in like this kind of crazy adventure. He's like, well, I'm going to go punch a lizard to feel better. I think he's a really good. I actually like the suit. I kind of give me that old like classic comedy movie where they just get a ratty old gorilla suit and slap it on someone and be like, hey, good news, buddy. You're going to go do a skit with the Three Stooges. There you go. Now you're good. So I kind of like it from that point, but it isn't the best Kong, but it's a serviceable Kong. And I kind of love how it serves the, I kind of found it that he's kind of like represents the more humorous side of the movie. Like how he's a drunk who's a part of the main salaryman plot, while Godzilla's more of the serious plot. So I kind of feel like his more ratty look compared to the more like streamlined and menacing Godzilla works that way.
The suit allows for enough range of motion that Hirose is able to do some really great and, I mean, obviously completely intentional physical comedy. I think Hirose gives one of the great kaiju performances here. He's able to physically just do a lot more than Nakajima is. Nakajima's genius, of course, is in his ability to suggest a lot about Godzilla with mostly relatively subtle movements, although, you know, he does the kind of big weird clapping here. But Hirose can really use, just put every joint of his body into creating these very evocative postures and gestures for Kong.
Yeah, in terms of the physical comedy that you mentioned, you're absolutely right. I really love the moment where when Godzilla and Kong first meet in this movie, and Kong, like when he's leaving and he's just walking and then he just picks his hand up and scratches his head like, what the hell just happened? It's so good.
I love that scene so much. He's just all like, ah, crap, another dinosaur. I'm ready to deal with you. And the minute he gets hit with the atomic breath, he's just like, yeah, no, I'm not doing this today. I honestly, it would have been incredibly ballsy, but I would have loved a version of that movie where that was a big fight and then it was just like dealing with Kong and Godzilla separately. Just would have been just like such a cap on all the satire here.
This movie is interesting because, well, for a lot of reasons, this movie is interesting in part because of what it represents in terms of the development of the formula of the Godzilla series. Because, I mean, you know, you'd had the original Godzilla, which was very much a self-contained single monster story. Then Godzilla Raids Again, which introduces the idea of monsters fighting. But Anguillus isn't really that significant a part of that movie and is dispatched halfway through. And then no Godzilla movies for 7 years, and now we get our first really big Toho monster versus monster movie, and they don't yet have a formula for it. And so, you know, if you compare it to what comes later, it takes a long time for this movie to even get around to Kong and Godzilla fighting, and that first fight is nothing. It's, you know, it's this quick little throwaway thing that basically establishes one monster has no chance against the other. And usually the first fight does have sort of set up one character as the underdog, but it does it so quickly, and it's just structured so much differently while still hitting the same basic beats as many, many, many of the movies that would follow.
Yeah, it's really insane that this movie kind of starts everything. The basic tropes of this series all started here, and I kind of think they do it very, very well.
I also made note of the fact that in terms of just the interesting choices in terms of the timing of some of these sequences, the octopus sequence goes on for a total of 6 minutes and 15 seconds in the Japanese cut. But of that, 4 minutes and 45 seconds is just the octopus attack and the natives and Sakurai fighting it off. And then only 1.5 minutes of that elapses from Kong's arrival to the end of the fight. So the octopus on its own gets substantially more screen time than Kong fighting the octopus. And that first Kong-Godzilla encounter Yeah, from the time that Kong is first approaching Godzilla until the point where Kong turns away completely, that is about 2 minutes and 38 seconds. And a lot of that time is just building up and then slowly letting down. From the time Kong throws the first rock at Godzilla until the point where Kong basically seems to give up is only 35 seconds. So basically that first fight is 35 seconds long.
Wow. Something I love about this King Kong is, and we'll get to the point where he uses it later, but something I love about this King Kong is the lightning powers. I think they are super cool. It's kind of odd. I don't know why like they chose that specifically, but I think it's rad. And I honestly wish it would come back someday. I was hoping they were going to use it in Godzilla versus Kong, but the axe is dope too. So I'm not upset, but I just want the lightning powers to come back. They're dope. Imagine Kong pulling back his fist and just landing a fucking lightning punch on someone. That'd be sick.
Clearly they're saving that for Son of Kong, where he realizes he's Kong, King of the Hollow Earth, and not Kong, King of the Axes, and then proceeds to kill a bunch of Gorosauruses while Immigrant Song plays.
Can't wait.
But yeah, I really love the lightning powers. They are such a cool addition. I'm really, really, really would have liked to see it, but I'm also okay with the axe and like the more physical Kong we saw.
Yeah, I feel like King Kong versus Godzilla does kind of like the whole idea of charging up the axe and all that. I felt like probably had its roots in Kong's electrical powers here. But yeah, I would love a good just Kong electro fist to come back.
I could definitely see that. I really like how it's like, it happens, everyone's shocked, and like, I don't know his name, but the other scientist, the one who kind of looks like, honestly kind of dressed like E.J. Tsuburaya, just kind of tells the reporters, go ask Segazawa about it. Segazawa's like, well, this guy got charged by lightning once in Poland. Like, even the movie itself is just like, baffled, and just kind of like, yeah, whatever. Monkey can do that now.
Everyone's surprised by it, except in the American cut, where Dr. Arnold Johnson tells us about it before we have a chance to see it on camera. So I don't know how Dr. Johnson knew about this, because while I know more about chimpanzees than gorillas, I've read enough about primates in general that I'm relatively confident that in real life, that's not a thing.
You know, but the world would be a lot cooler if it was.
Oh God, yes. If you had lightning gorillas and thunder orangutans. Hell and yeah. Maybe just wind chimps.
Yeah, the wind chimps.
I don't know
chimps.
What that would mean, but it would be cool.
Give me the wind chimps.
Come on, why are we making like pesticide-free tomatoes when these are the GMOs we can be making, guys?
So let's move on to our other titular monster here, Godzilla. I absolutely love this Godzilla. He looks fantastic. I love the iceberg thing. Like, this movie and Mothra versus Godzilla, I don't know what it is about these two movies, but they were just like, let's give Godzilla a couple really cool entrances. Well, I know it is with this movie. It's continuity from the last one. But still, it's so cool. It's just like, when you first see the glowing iceberg, I just get so hyped every time I watch this. And ever since I watched the US cut as a kid, I've just absolutely adored seeing Godzilla burst his way out of that iceberg. It's just so awesome.
Because it is such a beautiful Godzilla suit. I know that from a very, very head-on angle, looking straight at the face, it looks kind of weird. Whatever. It's a beautiful suit. It's shot beautifully in the movie. And both because it's such a great iconic design, but also because this movie was such a huge hit in Japan, and because of Universal's involvement, got, for the genre, a particularly notable release in the US. In terms of merchandising, this Godzilla became largely sort of the default design that Godzilla figures and models and things tended to be based on up until really the Heisei series. So growing up in that time, this was just this was what Godzilla looked like.
Yeah, this Godzilla is fantastic. The design is incredible. I love how it's more reptilian, but and also so bulky and thick. It like instantly stands out from the 50s Godzillas while still feeling like its own thing and the same character. I really do love how he's this big threat with these moments of levity. I feel like this movie in particular is one that, like, made Godzilla, because while there is definitely some moments of character and especially sympathy in the early 50s, in the 50s films, which is fantastic, I feel like this is when Nakajima kind of finds his, like, core of the character, where he really starts to get, like, okay, this is how Godzilla reacts when he's getting attacked. This is how he, like, shows he's angry. This is how he shows, like, he's enjoying himself. It's really when I feel like he starts to settle into the role and it starts, Godzilla really becomes Godzilla and not just another run-of-the-mill monster from the Atomic Age.
Well, yeah, the first two times that Nakajima played Godzilla, well, I mean, the first time that he played him, he was in a suit so heavy that asking much more of him than go that way for a minute was a lot. But in those first couple of movies, he and Katsumi Tezuka were really just figuring out the most basic concepts of how do you get inside one of these suits and make it move. And by this point, he'd played several different monsters, and I think he was probably himself more acutely aware of wanting to establish a distinctive personality for Godzilla to make Godzilla different from Varan, Rodan, Mulgara. And yes, he does it exceptionally well. This Godzilla really does have, you know, I was talking about how much Hirose is able to move in that Kong suit, but as I said earlier, Nakajima can do so much with so little. And yeah, I think this is one of the all-time definitive Godzilla performances.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, Nakajima's Godzilla performances throughout the 60s are just astounding. Like, he does such a good job in that decade. I mean, he only played Godzilla twice in the 70s, but and no disrespect here, but in those two films, to me personally, I don't quite enjoy the suit acting as much as I do in the 60s, aside from certain things he does in Hedorah. But overall, yeah, the 60s is where it's at for me in terms of Nakajima's Godzilla performances, especially this film and Mothra versus Godzilla, and I'd say Ebera. Horror of the Deep is really good in that regard as well.
So a few new features of Godzilla here, not counting the suit that was made for the volcano monsters and shipped to the US, but in terms of suits that were actually used on camera in movies, this is the suit that introduced a Godzilla without ears. This is the suit that introduced a three-toed Godzilla. And then this being the first Godzilla movie in color, this is where his heat ray takes on a color. Previously, you know, it was just sort of white, smoky looking. But here it takes on a bluish hue.
It also, they have the tail rounded out here, and they give him that iconic spine shape that he will have pretty much forever. So yeah, this suit was extremely influential, understandably, because it just looks fantastic.
I do find it weird that the green didn't take off outside of like public perception though. But I also wanted to say quickly, I think thinking on it, my favorite thing about this movie is how basically this is a wrestling match and it's Godzilla being like a perfect heel. He's just like an absolute dick, and I love it. He's just like a total bully to Kong. He's just like having a great time smashing shit, and it's just like, oh, it's just kind of so much fun to see. Like, we've had a lot of like intentionally evil Godzillas, we've had a lot of heroic Godzillas, but this is like my favorite, like, just kind of like doing his own thing, Godzilla.
Of course, Kong is completely the aggressor in that. Well, I mean, the second time he's kind of dropped on Godzilla, but the first time Kong is out looking for this fight, and it's suggested that Kong is instinctively seeking Godzilla out as a rival, which is an interesting juxtaposition with Godzilla versus Kong, of course. You know, I mean, also Kong narratively is just the one driving the story a lot more. you know, as great, as iconic as this Godzilla is, ultimately it's a little bit more Kong's movie. You know, he was the bigger star at the time. He gets the top billing. It is his theme song that that goes over the opening credits.
I'm actually going to disagree with you there, Evan. I find it the opposite. This one, even though he's not really the protagonist, and it's just kind of like the main obstacle of the plot, I always felt like this was more of a Godzilla movie. Like, the plot revolves more around him. Kong is just like the solution they come up with to deal with Godzilla. But that's just kind of me. I don't know. I think that also might be because I definitely think, in comparison to Godzilla vs. Kong, it's definitely a lot more of a Godzilla movie.
Oh, it is definitely. Whichever character you say is the dominant one in this, I think it's undeniable that it's a much more evenly balanced movie between the two than Godzilla vs. Kong, and also does a much better job of getting its disparate groups of characters to interact significantly. One thing that I wanted to talk about a little bit is the amount, or is the use of composite shots in this movie. Now, a couple years later, in Mothra vs. Godzilla, you would see Tsuburaya really, like, perfecting composite shots using giant monsters. Here, the work is a little clunkier. This movie, I think, has a reputation for particularly bad composite shots in the U.S., which has a lot to do with how poorly U.S. prints for this movie were handled. Everything is way too bright throughout the whole movie. Like, there are scenes where just, like, the dramatic lighting is absolutely ruined in the American prints. And the blue composite lines become really, really noticeable in American prints of this movie, where in Japanese prints, where particularly where night scenes are more heavily tinted to look like night, that compositing looks a lot better. You can't see nearly, there are still some blue lines that make their way in, but not nearly as many. During the octopus sequence, there are some moments where the camera moves on one element of a composite and not the other, and it's rather jarring. But there is a really great, rather tricky composite shot later on in the movie that I quite like, which is when Kong has picked up the train car that Fumiko is in, because of course it's the train car that Fumiko is in, and he's looking through it. There's a zoom, it's a composited shot, which, yes, does have some clear blue lines in it, where we're looking through the train car with Fumiko dangling inside it to Kong's face in the background. So we zoom in, and they have to match the zoom on the train car and Fumiko element with the zoom on Kong's face. And I think it looks fantastic. It's a really dramatic, impactful moment. And it really helps to sell the scale of Kong. And I think there are a few other moments where they really sell the scale of Kong quite well, such as the composite shots of the native islanders dancing around the sleeping Kong before he's taken away, where, again, if you watch the American version, it kind of looks like garbage. Not on the topic of compositing, but just a wonderful sort of selection of miniatures that I wanted to talk about are in the scenes that involve the transportation of Kong from Faroe Island to Japan. There are some wonderful shots there where you've got the Kong suit on this raft being towed by a miniature ship, which look really, really good. Those are very impressive shots. The miniature helicopter that brings Taco in doesn't look quite as good, or I think more to the point, its motion doesn't look quite as good, but it's still very effective. There's some nice use of little model people on the ship from the sort of bird's eye view of the helicopter, and then there's a little model Taco that is lowered from the helicopter that I think works quite well. Works a lot better than the doll of Fumiko that they use later in the movie. And then there's a really good shot when the second ship, the destroyer, is approaching them, where you're seeing bits of the main miniature ship, Kong on the raft, and this really good-looking miniature destroyer approaching. I mean, It's super impressive work.
A miniature that I really like is, I mean, it's not just the miniature itself, but what they do to it is the melting tank when Godzilla is attacking the military base and he's, you know, firing his atomic breath and everything. It's such a contrast to Godzilla's atomic breath in later films where it just blows everything up. But this film and Mothra versus Godzilla, you get some really cool like tanks melting, and I just really love that.
Yeah, I really like the melting tank effects. Also with the electrical towers, they do kind of a similar thing to what they did in the original movie where the towers went white with heat. Here, when they're all charged up and Godzilla is interacting with them, there's a little bit of red that shows up on them. And then when they start like overcharging as Kong is sucking the energy out of them, there's a much, like they go much, much more red. I thought that was a cool effect. And again, the miniatures look great.
I agree. There are some fantastic effects here. I really love the bit with the trucks digging up the hole for Operation Burial. I think that's, I might be biased because there's a very good story about an August Ragone's Tsuburaya biography, but it's just a really realistic looking thing for miniatures. Having watched this film for like the fifth time now, I think I can say this confidently. My least favorite part of this might be Operation Burial. I love the electric wire setup and the whole switcheroo it does with Kong, Godzilla, and the reactions. I dig the hell out of transporting King Kong, but I think Operation Burial might be my least favorite of all the military set pieces in the series. I don't know what it is. I can't get into it. It's very bit weird, and it makes me feel bad, but I don't know.
I mostly like it for the moment when Godzilla pops back up after being buried.
Same.
I think that's a super cool shot. And I mean, we're going to talk about the music later, but it's a moment where I think the music really works in the Japanese cut.
I do agree with that. I love the end of that scene, but at that point, I think it's kind of like over. I don't know. It just, and I do like the fire. I really miss the idea of Godzilla being lured to fire and light. And I really love the whole river of fire.
The fire is so beautiful.
It really is. But it's just like, I don't know. Is there something about how the rest of it that just doesn't grab me? And I don't know what it is. I really like Odaku. I think he's a cool octopus. I just think the idea of Kong fighting an octopus is just such a neat and unique take on the idea of Kong fighting some threat on his island. Sorry, I keep calling it Skull Island. I know it's Pharaoh, but I just really like it. And I think the effects are really good. And I freaking love that Tsuburaya ate one of the octopuses they shot with for dinner. That's just really cool. I don't like the lizard, though. The lizard's kind of dumb.
The big lizard that Furue throws?
Yeah, I don't know. It just kind of feels random. And
I'll be bringing him up again in a moment.
I just feel like he feels kind of random, and he's just like a not very convincing looking prop. Well, actually, I should explain more. I feel like he's not so much random in the context of the movie. Like, he works in the movie as this random lizard. It's more random when you're like me and you're introduced to this series through a couple of movies, and then you go to find out more information, and you see this clearly fake rubber lizard listed along the likes of King Kong, giant octopuses, Rodan, Mothra, and all this other stuff on certain websites. And you're just like, why is this here?
That's weird. Yeah, that's very, very weird.
It's so strange because like they'll have him listed as giant lizard, which is extremely misleading and stupid because he's not even like giant. Like, he's not even that big for, like, lizard standards. Like, there are, like, iguanas get so much bigger than that. Like, it's just so, it's so
right?
Dumb.
It's just a regular-ass lizard. I kind of love that. I kind of love if, like, in the next Son of Kong fight, Adam Wingard, there's just, like, a friggin', that lizard is like the only, it's one of like the many creatures there as like just a regular ass lizard versus all these weird hybrid monsters. But like, it's to see it along the ranks of so many other kaiju, it's just kind of like, what are you doing here, dude?
Yeah, it is really weird to me to have that thought of as a kaiju. That's a bizarre notion. Another special effects moment I wanted to call out is just when they're getting Kong all prepped with the wires and the balloons. Oh, what a delightful image. I love the use of cell animated soldiers walking around on Kong's body. That's really, really cool.
Oh, wow. I completely missed that.
I think the first time I really noticed it was at a screening in theater at the New Beverly in Hollywood of The American Cut. It was a double feature with Mothra. It was a good day.
That does sound like a really good day.
Yeah, we went to El Coyote and got margaritas first. It was the bomb.
Nice. Okay, so let's talk about this title fight here at the end of the film. This is one of my favorite monster fights ever. Specifically after Kong gets revived with the lightning and the fight just becomes super frantic. I love the way it's shot and cut. It just feels super rapid and aggressive and energetic, and it's just such a blast to watch. It blew me away the first time I watched this film. I was like on an adrenaline rush by the time the film ended. But yeah, it's so much fun to watch.
It is, without hyperbole, one of the best fights in the entire series. It's just like the perfect mix of these real stakes with this like perfect half serious, half slapstick fighting. It's just incredible. I love everything. There's so many iconic bits. The tree choke, the tail kick. It's just so good. I have more to say, but I'm going to save it because it's more about how the fight ends. But I just, it's so good. I literally wrote my notes on this whole thing. I had a time just so I could watch it without having to worry about taking notes.
Yeah, I mean, the whole fight lasts about just over 9 minutes, which if you compare that to a lot of the fights in, say, the Heisei and Millennium era movies, that's quite short. But they pack in so much action, they pack in so many different phases to the fight that it's totally satisfying. You know, it doesn't need to be any longer than 9 minutes because you get everything. You get so much, and it's all so much fun. And you know, both monsters get their time on top. Both monsters get to do some clowning around, and have moments where they're genuinely kind of intimidating. It's really quite possibly my favorite giant monster fight ever. One thing that kind of leapt out at me on this viewing, one of the things that I was looking at as I was this viewing, I watched it 5 times in various versions in prep for this podcast. But I was sort of looking at all of the references to baseball and to wrestling, because of course one of the things this movie was dealing with was the loss of film audiences to television, and a lot of what they were watching was baseball and wrestling, and that is why there is so much talk about Godzilla versus Kong as a wrestling match, and why so much of their fighting seems to, you know, is sort of based in a wrestling style. But after that initial, you know, and we haven't really talked about how marvelous the image of King Kong being held aloft by giant yellow balloons is. That's fantastic. And then there's just great these great bird's eye view shots of Godzilla making his way up Mount Fuji from the helicopter. Although they should have been through Sakurai's camera lens. But regardless, great shot there. But then where I was going with all of that is when Kong and Godzilla, after they initially slam together, Kong goes up and sort of hides in a depression atop Mount Fuji, and Godzilla comes and finds him. And it sort of struck me this time that they're basically in a big wrestling ring there.
Jesus, I didn't even notice that. You're totally right, though.
So one of the highlights that I often see talked about with this fight is the destruction of Atami Castle, because it's awesome. It's one of the coolest moments in a Godzilla movie, in my opinion.
Oh, it's absolutely iconic.
Yeah, for real. And I wanted to read this tweet from at Space Hunter M on Twitter, obviously, considering I said tweet. It's something I never thought about because I didn't really know the history behind this castle here. So the tweet reads, "The destruction of a Tommy Castle, a non-historical tourist location constructed only 3 years prior to the film, is the ultimate visual extension of King Kong vs. Godzilla's commercialism satire. It's what the monsters have to say about their conflict being used to buy airtime." And I just think that's really cool. I didn't know that that was just some tourist location. And I really like whenever you have things in, when you have moments of the filmmakers being like, hey, this building in particular for a specific reason in a Godzilla movie. I just think that's always really great.
And Fujita even calls it out by name.
That's just great. I really love that because it's mainly just a great visual of them like destroying a building to go to get a crack at the other. But like that added symbolism is just like the cherry on top of the satire sundae. I really love that it ends in a draw. People have talked about this before, but the thing that makes this movie more than just monster versus monster is that these are, like, in-universe are gods. Godzilla is this ancient, dreaded god of Odo Island. Kong is this legendary beast of Pharaoh Island who is worshipped and feared. And so it really makes it fitting to me that they just kind of, like, go off on their own separate ways without a clear winner. It really feels like an old-fashioned myth where they, like, they're the winner of this contest, but then they just go off on their own separate ways until they meet again in some other great myth or a 2021 blockbuster.
Yeah, it is. It is a nice, you know, you don't need one monster to die. You don't need a big, you know, dramatic explosion. The moment where the two of them hit the water together is plenty climax enough. They're both great monsters. They both have, you know, bright futures ahead of, well, Kong's immediate future is the Rankin Bass animated series, and King Kong escapes in his immediate future. But Godzilla has great things waiting for him.
Yeah.
It's almost like a bad movie about Hollywood. The famous actor has his struggling up-and-comer star in his latest feature, but he ends up becoming so popular, he ends up taking the spotlight from him for years.
I hope we get more Kong content in the future. I know the next potential MonsterVerse film is right now supposed to be a Kong film. So I kind of hope Kong gets some more time in the spotlight soon. I think that would be nice, and it would be good for him to have more than just remakes. Because, you know, it's just, I just like monster franchises. I don't care if you milk them. if the movies are fun, then I'm happy.
Yes, perhaps now is the time for a recharged Kong to grab Godzilla by the tail and toss him out of the MonsterVerse. We didn't talk about the iconic grabbing by the tail and throw. Of course, most iconic as a still photograph from an angle that's not in the movie. But that wonderful moment where Kong grabs Godzilla, you know, after taking his electrical charge, grabs Godzilla and with his crackling electrical fists, grabs him by the tail and hurls him through the air. A moment which I again, just on my most recent viewing this afternoon before this podcast put together, is foreshadowed on Pharaoh Island by Furue grabbing that lizard by the tail and throwing it.
Okay, maybe a little bigger than that, stupid then.
Yeah, that is a great moment in the fight. Though I will say, I will be a little sad if we don't see Godzilla in the MonsterVerse again, but that's just me. So let's move on to this film's score, which is by none other than Akira Ifukube.
Do we have a theme that we can play for the entrance of the Enter Godzilla theme? Because it's so important that it deserves its own theme.
Yeah.
Iconic.
Yeah.
Literally iconic.
Yes.
It still so crazy to me that it's like, you would have thought, I just love that theme so much. I just love the score so much. It really is some of Ifukube's top work.
Yeah, this is the first use of the classic Godzilla fanfare. It's my favorite version of it. Like, there's something about, like, the mix on the score of this movie. It just sounds so good. And there's, like, Ifukube kind of changes the theme slightly after this movie. Here, there's just, I'm not sure, I don't really know notes or anything like that. I've never studied music theory, but there's just like one or two notes in the beginning of the theme that are just a little different, and I really prefer it the way it sounds here, because in my opinion, it sounds a lot more menacing that way to me, and I just really enjoy it.
Yeah, I would say even by Mothra versus Godzilla, you've got a slightly more sympathetic Godzilla, and I suppose it makes sense that the thing that theme evolved into isn't necessarily quite as much a horror theme as it is here.
Speaking from what I can tell, I know, it's kind of like, okay, I'm going to sound like a jerk here. I learned how to, through piano tutorials and transcribing, I kind of learned the difference between the themes. It's kind of like, this one is kind of having repeating the same themes in both the melody and I can't remember what it's called, and I'm just call it the bass line, to like make it sound stronger when it goes like ba da 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 da. But the later films kind of use it as like a descending version. I don't know. It definitely, I agree with Evan. It kind of makes the difference between like a very like he's the hit very strong horror theme and like a more of a sympathetic monster theme. That makes no sense, but I'm hoping someone out here will understand it. Hold on a second.
A few moments later.
Okay, so just pulling out my old keyboard. It kind of goes from like. Two. And so it kind of like changes from like more of a like build up to the main like done, the big conclusion, to like this more slow kind of like, holy crap, look at this scene, at least from my terrible explanation of it.
That's really cool. I never, ever noticed that.
Again, I only noticed because I was like, these sound different when I was like bored at my piano classes messing around with the themes.
I just think it's interesting that decades later in Godzilla versus Destroyer, during the closing credits, where the movie, you know, the visuals of the credits are paying tribute to all of the Heisei movies, but the music that comes up when the credits start is the Faroe Island chanting, like Kong's theme from this movie. You know, that at the dramatic climax of the Heisei movies, they're still paying tribute to King Kong versus Godzilla, and it's iconic, you know, masterful score. I think if there's a definitive Godzilla movie score, it's probably Mothra versus Godzilla, like just sort of slightly refining a lot of what was done here. But boy, this is a great, great score.
So yeah, that takes me to this film's opening theme. Which, you know, this is common knowledge, but that opening theme absolutely slaps ass. Like, it's so good. It gets stuck in my head, and it just prepares you for the awesomeness that is this movie. And it is, in my opinion, one of the just absolute top greatest pieces of music in the Godzilla franchise.
I agree.
And in my opinion, the greatest piece of music in any Kong movie.
I agree. Like, Fair Island Chant is a fucking bop. And Tom Hulkenberg, yes, I know your name now. I'm not going to call you Junkie XL like in the GVK episode. You should have fucking gotten the rights to that and remastered it for Godzilla vs. Kong. You coward.
I don't think he could have done it justice. That's just my opinion. So to me, I'm glad it didn't come back for that movie.
True, he might just make a ripoff theme.
No disrespect, but he can't touch this score.
He did much better than the Americanization of this score, though.
That's true. Very true. I like that. I like the Godzilla vs. Kong score, but it's nothing compared to this.
Once again, to come back to the Americanization of this movie, I think one of the great tragedies is the near complete loss of Ifukube's score. A few little bits of music. I mean, that Godzilla march, which is used four or five times in this movie, is completely absent. Every musical replacement is inferior. Like, just not even close. You think about the impact of Godzilla popping out of the earth and that theme coming up, and or Godzilla revealed in the iceberg and that theme coming up, and none of it plays quite as well in the American version.
No, it definitely doesn't. It just completely removes the power from these monsters.
That is the biggest tragedy. My favorite time watching the U.S. cut of King Kong vs. Godzilla was when I pulled out my phone and literally just started playing the cues on the album while I watched it. Just like the FQVQ is like, there's the Kong theme, there's the transporting theme. My favorite time by far.
Yeah, I can see where that would be an improvement.
So I just wanted to point out that the track that plays when Fumiko is trying to hide the fact that she's worried about Vegeta. That later becomes the Infant Island theme in Mothra vs. Godzilla. And I just thought that was kind of neat. And of course, the theme that plays when Godzilla and Kong are fighting is later repurposed in Godzilla vs. King Ghidorah. And in my opinion, quite intentionally, because that was originally supposed to be a rematch between Godzilla and King Kong.
Yeah, that's right. I think that was such a cool little thing. I really loved how Ifukube reused some of his old themes for the Heisei stuff, but I'm going to talk about that when we get to those, I think.
So let's move on to stray thoughts, of which I have none, so go wild.
I was going to say something, a stray thought I had was watching the scenes of Seahawk, it kind of struck me that this is the first real time in the series that we're like exploring something outside of the Japan bubble. Like, we mention America in Godzilla 54. There's something in Raids Again that's escaping me at the moment. But this is the first time that, like, we see American. We see the situation going beyond just Japan. It's interesting. It gives us more of an international feel. And again, also helps lead to, like, how the series is going to move forward once this movie, after this movie.
Yeah, that's true. I hadn't thought of that.
So I wanted to talk a little bit. I've said some unkind things about the American cut of this movie, but there are elements of it that I appreciate, and I'd like to take a minute to talk about a few of them, although in the process I may end up mentioning some that I don't like also, but I'm going to try to focus on the positive. First of all, I like the voices chosen for most of the characters. In particular, I think that the voice actor for Sakurai is a really good fit for the character. I find him really likable. I also think the voice for Furue and the voice for Taco work very well. It always throws me that for Senkichi Omura's character, Kono, the translator, since they were dubbing the Japanese dialogue, but not the Faroe Island dialogue, he ended up in the American cut having two different voices. So that's a little funky. But other than that, I generally really like the voices used in this dub. I like the way that the scenes involving the Seahawk are recut. In the Japanese version, the Seahawk sequence is about 3.5 minutes long, but it's spread over three different sections that are kind of cut in awkwardly relative to the rest of them. I mean, the dialogue indicates that we're getting them in the intended scripted order, but they feel very awkwardly placed. Also, the passage of time doesn't make much sense. We see the Seahawk dive, then a few scenes later, there's coverage in the newspaper of what we've just seen happening with them, which is pretty impressive. Then when we cut back to them, they're still diving, which makes no sense. They then collide with the iceberg. The next scene, we return to Sakurai and Furue, and it is established that at least 5 days have passed since the previous scene with them. But then all the reporters have left because of a big news story, which is implicitly the thing that's still going on with the Seahawk, where we cut back to them having just collided with the iceberg. So none of it makes any sense. But that's fridge logic. That doesn't really matter. What does matter is that it really lacks dramatic tension. And by cutting it all together into a single sequence in the American cut, which is also about 30 seconds shorter, just killing bits of redundancy here and there, you end up with something a lot more tense and dramatic. It's really effective. And, you know, It doesn't ruin the Japanese version. They're still good sequences, but there's a lot more punch to them in the American version. Another thing that I like in the dub, in the scene where they are presenting the chief with the radio, Sakurai says, all the other chiefs will shake and tremble. And when he says that, Furue goes, like me, while trembling in the background. That was just a nice little touch. Although it is unfortunate that they interrupt the scene of Fujita rushing to save Fumiko, one thing that I did like is that when they cut from Sahara back to James Yagi as Yutaka Omura, we go from a shot of Sahara's car traveling from left to right into a tunnel to a shot where Omura is stepping into the shot from frame left. So it carries that dynamic sense of action across from the previous shot, even though it is, in fact, stopping the movie dead at a terrible moment to just summarize things that are better, more organically established in the Japanese version. But the edit is good. And I love the line, King Kong can't make a monkey out of us. So thank you, American dub, for that.
I think that is my favorite line in the entire American dub. And I was immensely disappointed when I finally watched the Japanese cut and found out it wasn't in the original, because it fits in so well.
You know, I don't mind the corns thing. I know people talk about the corns part a lot and how that's not at all what they're saying in the Japanese version. But while I wouldn't take it over the Japanese version, there's just something about Sakurai's voice actor, his delivery of, I don't care about your corns, that's really good.
I 100% agree. I also like the guy dubbing Furue's delivery of the corns.
Yeah, it's really good.
The corns are the second best.
Furue, what is it? What hurts?
The corns.
I don't want to hear about your corns.
I want to agree with you, though, about Sakurai's voice actor. I think I totally agree that he's a very good fit for that character.
So there are a few more little editorial moments that I wanted to call out. At around 15 minutes and 50 seconds or so, basically when Godzilla is not shown for the first time, but when the Seahawk is destroyed, there's a great dissolve where you're looking up at Godzilla's flames sort of rolling across the ceiling of the submarine, and that dissolves to the rolling of sort of choppy waters below as we see the boat approaching Faroe Island. That's a really nice cut. At around 20:43, and I think this will vary slightly depending on what edition of the movie you're looking at and where the how the different company titles are timed out. But around 20:43, when the radio is first turned on and the islanders all react to it, there's a very slight jump cut there that just makes it a very jarring moment for the audience. You know, you're kind of snapped by it. And then at about 23 minutes and 30 seconds, we hear Kong roar, and then we cut to a shot of a lion roaring on a television set, which Fumiko is watching back home, which, first of all, it's a neat sort of audio cut. It's very clever. And also, you know, in its way, it kind of brings you back to the idea that, like, they're trying to commercialize. They're trying to turn this into a monster for television. You know, they want to trap this roar in the box, just like the lion's roar has been trapped. I may be stretching there, but it's a great cut.
I love that cut a lot. It stands out every time.
I missed it because I was note-taking, but I really do love that one.
The scene when Fujita comes back and encounters Tamie, and, you know, she realizes that he's not dead, is just beautifully lit. It's all very source motivated, but it's kind of atmospheric and even a little creepy, particularly when Fujita has walked over closer to Tamie, and the light that's being cast on his face forms this kind of semicircle where his eyes are lit, but there's a lot of fall off when you get down to his mouth, it's largely in shadow. And then cutting over to Tamie, even as she is sort of moving around, her face just stays perfectly framed in this kind of warm light that then falls off around the edges. It's really marvelous looking, and it's all printed too brightly in the American version. And while it doesn't look bad, it doesn't look remotely as good or have any of the same eerie impact. But it's just beautiful. It's some of the best looking human footage in, I think, any Godzilla movie ever.
Okay, so, guys, who's your MVP of this movie?
I am going to give MVP on this one to Shinichi Sekizawa. Absolutely. I think that this is a movie... I mean, obviously, this is a movie that works because a massive team of talented people at the height of their creativity were all collaborating on it. But I think this one, it has Sekizawa's fingerprints all over it. So much of what works about it works because of the sort of silly, smirking, satirical tone that he brought to the script. Things like the way that the baseball references are woven in, and the wrestling references, like all of the self-reflexivity and the social satire in there. That is the glue that binds this movie together.
That was the main one I was thinking of. So thank you for taking for me, because now I can narrow down my choices. I really love Nakajima and Arashima. They both get honorable MVPs, but I'm going to go for this MVP with Akira Fukube himself. I haven't gotten a chance to talk about how much I friggin' adore his music yet, and this is one of his best scores, so I have to give it to him. This is literally the groundwork of, like, a friggin' career of music here, so I have to give it the MVP.
Shout out to Ichiro Arashima for giving one of my absolute favorite performances of a human character in any Godzilla movie. Seriously, just everything is perfect. I wanted to give him my MVP, but I've got to give it to Eiji Tsuburaya. Just because, despite my feelings about Kong, the effects in this film are just fantastic. And he nails the final fight so hard. And that is so crucial to this movie specifically. I think if in a movie called King Kong versus Godzilla, if that fight isn't absolutely awesome, then this movie falls apart, in my opinion, no matter how good everything else is, because that's ultimately, I don't want to say it's the point, but it's kind of the point. If you can't make King Kong fighting Godzilla one of the coolest things you've ever seen, then you just shouldn't have made this movie. And Tsuburaya and everyone involved with this fight just knocked it out of the park. It's so good. So much fun. I love it. So Eiji Tsuburaya gets my MVP. Before we get into our final thoughts, here is Andrew's thoughts on King Kong versus Godzilla.
Hi, this is Andrew. You may have noticed that I haven't been on this show. If you didn't, I'm clearly doing something wrong in all the rest of the episodes. I decided to bow out today because, honestly, I feel that this is a truly fantastic movie, and I equally feel like I would not do it justice. Honestly, This is in my top 10, maybe my top 5, but it's so hard to rank Godzilla films past a certain level these days when it's just like you get to this top 5 or 10 or 15 where you like, but these are all masterpieces. But this one is a relatively recent entrant to the list for me in the last few years. And for whatever reason, I just feel intimidated about the possibility of waxing poetic over it, despite the fact there is so much to wax poetic over. So I wanted to step aside and let some of the other super fans that have been real enthusiasts for this film for much longer really step in and give it the treatment it deserves. But I did just want to at least briefly give my off-the-cuff, unrehearsed, very different from my usual note-heavy, observations and thoughts about the film. This is a great movie, obviously. That just goes without saying. One of the top grossers, I think maybe the top grosser of all time. I'm not sure if adjusted for inflation Shin beats this, but it's a record setter. It reinvigorated a franchise. It gave us a template that really existed for years to come. And that's not surprising. Despite a lackluster Kong suit, I mean, arguably the better of the Toho Kong suits, and, you know, the occasional wonky production values with some poor blue screen shots that I actually find quite hilarious, where you can see the shadows of the torches and the spears on the blue screen or rear projection wall that they're being thrown at during the giant octopus scene. This is a film that is just a lavish visual spectacle. The script is really funny, really peppy. Obviously, various different subtitles have captured that to different degrees of success. Personally, I feel like the Criterion subs really crackle with the energy and with the humor and with the verve and vigor and life of the script, but they do sacrifice a bit of accuracy for the sake of that. One of the things that irritates me most is when a character who is believed to be dead shows up at the front door and she drops the food she's carrying. I say he and she because obviously I did not just watch it, so I don't remember any of the names. And she's supposed to say, "You've got legs." And then he says, "I'm not a ghost." Because in Japanese culture, ghosts do not have legs. And you can even see him clearly look down at his legs. That's part of the whole gag. But the Criterion subs just substitute something generic like, "It's you," or "You're alive," or something. Regardless of that, there are some other fan subs that I think maybe capture the accuracy a bit better. But like I said, there is a zing to that Criterion subs that I appreciate. Either way, the Japanese version is head and shoulders above the American version, and one of the things that makes it so great is just how much it showcases the wonderful comedic role of Mr. Taco. I am sure I'm not the first person or the only person talking about Mr. Taco in this show, and that actually leads to one of the other bits of just esoteric Japanese wordplay that I love that you don't get in translation, where the giant octopus shows up in the village and the guy yells, "Taco," because that's also the Japanese word for octopus. And the other goes, "What, the boss? No, no, an actual taco." But yeah, Mr. Taco is a wonderful character, played as a broad comedic caricature and a satire of, you know, consumerism and commercialism. And he's just absolutely delightful. He's hilarious, you know, his shtick with repeatedly almost pressing the dynamite plunger. And it's just emblematic of all the wonderful, almost slapstick, you know, Looney Tunes kind of humor that the character is infused with. It is a magnificent performance and legendary in the halls of Toho kaiju history. But really, all of the characters are very likable, very charismatic. It's a fun ensemble. It's full of goofy concepts, but honestly, it delivers. And it manages to take the inherently uneven matchup of a very reptilian dinosaurish, more so than ever, I think, in any other design looking Godzilla here, and the relatively unpowered mammalian Kong. And it makes it work. It doesn't try to oversell. Yeah, Godzilla's atomic breath is going to wreck Kong. Kong's just like, heck with that, pieces out until he gets a power-up out of nowhere. But it works. It works. And it's a fun battle. You have that great castle destruction. It not only is a wonderful showcase between a pair of kaiju that were quite famous and legendary. So, of course, there was marquee value in in making them come together, but it makes the story actually about having a title match between the two characters in a very clever, very meta way. And I'm just all over the map here, I know, because there is so much to love about this film. But again, I feel like I'm not the best one to be discussing it, which is why my observations are so haphazard. I love the giant octopus. That is a wonderful bit of effect work, even the occasional stop motion in there to sell some of that. And you know, just the real close up of the real oozing, puckering, slimy, creepy organicness of an octopus on land really just sells that creepy, disturbing ick factor that makes it a wonderful opponent, even if it is one that is not particularly menacing once Kong arrives on the scene. You've got great music throughout, especially, you know, the iconic King Kong sort of chants that the Islanders are doing. Some great comedic shtick with the Islanders, and especially for me, Senkichi Omura's delightful turn as the translator. I don't know what it is, but there's just something so wonderfully expressive in his facial expressions and body language that I'd put him second only to Mr. Taco in terms of just the fantastic comedic characters in this movie. And that's about it. Honestly, I can gush in a random, very disorganized manner, but I find it hard to nail down or find anything really original or unique to say about a film. I mean, what can be said that hasn't already been said throughout the years and probably quite well by all of my colleagues in the preceding show? King Kong vs. Godzilla is a fantastic movie. The Japanese version especially is eye-openingly just a fantastic comedy that thankfully is finally available, even if limitedly on U.S. shores. Of course, we're all awaiting a proper release of the Japanese 4K version so that we don't have some of the color distortions and quality differences throughout the film. And when we get that with some proper English subtitles on it, or even the fan subs that are floating around, which are quite serviceable in their own right, then we will finally have the ultimate King Kong versus Godzilla, and that will be a happy day indeed. This is well-deserving of its classic status. It is just a phenomenal movie as a kaiju fight, as a showcase for two famous giant monsters, as a comedy, as a movie. It's just overall fantastic. And as Evan may or may not have pointed out during the show, I do think that the U.S. cut is superior in only one respect, and that is the dubbing and the editing for the submarine scene. All condensed together into one, I think works much better. In fact, I've created a fan edit of my own, inserting that version of it into the Japanese film and rearranging things a bit, which I think works quite well. King Kong vs. Godzilla is absolutely worth the effort of tracking down the Japanese version to watch it. It is one of the gems of the Showa era, especially of its golden age. And I really just can't say enough good things about it. Before I go, in the hopes that we have attracted a fairly large audience, certainly discussion for this film deserves it, it's quite evident by our download numbers that classic Showa films like this one, as well as our MonsterVerse series, draw in the largest crowd of listeners, and our Zone Fighter coverage draws in the fewest, sometimes half or even a third of what some of these other discussion episodes garner. And I'd just like to put in a plea to anyone listening that hasn't gone and checked those out. Zone Fighter is a single season, 26 episode series that is canon to the Toho Godzilla series. It's actually part of the Showa films. It comes in between Godzilla vs. Megalon and Godzilla vs. Mechagodzilla. Godzilla makes numerous appearances, as well as King Ghidorah and even the conclusion of Gigan's storyline from the previous two films. It is absolutely a part of Showa Godzilla and well worth checking out for any fans of this character and especially this era. And if you haven't seen this, of course you haven't, because this hasn't been available in the US before now, but it was subtitled in a project that I spearheaded last year and is now available for general release. And in fact, on archive.org, you can even view it for free. We put a lot of work into those episodes, and I think it has generated some of our great discussions and especially great in-jokes. if you enjoyed this episode and you enjoy the discussion of our Showa classics, I'd really urge you to come check out our Zone Fighter episodes in the archives, especially now that the whole series has concluded. We can very easily point you to where you can watch them online for free, so actually being familiar with the source material won't be any barrier, and the series itself is a wacky, crazy, wild ride into a very Jet Jaguar-esque giant superhero versus monsters sort of adventure series that is crazy and off the wall and well worth checking out for any Godzilla fan. Certainly not on the level of King Kong versus Godzilla, but we would love to have you as audience members and participants with us in both of them. As for King Kong versus Godzilla, if this is one that you have not really bothered tracking down, not really gone to the effort of watching the original Japanese version, or never really given a very high regard or been dismissive of, well then, I guess that you, as Godzilla fans, must change how you treat absolute classic Toho films. It's time to learn from them. That's all I have to say.
So let's finally move in to our final thoughts on King Kong versus Godzilla.
Classic, that's all I can say. Just, if you need to see a classic Godzilla film because you're interested in the series, I think this is a good choice, but you gotta get the Japanese cut. I know, subtitles, you don't watch movies or read. Trust me, it's worth it. This movie is 59 years old, and the jokes still work today. It's worth it. Trust me.
This movie is inexhaustibly entertaining. I mean, I've watched it 5 times in a little over a week, and that's, you know, after watching it countless times over the last 32 years, and it just never fails to entertain me, even if I'm watching one of the inferior edits. It's just a delight. It is a movie where a bunch of great creative minds were firing on all cylinders, and where, thanks to an unfortunate history in which some other talented minds got kind of screwed over, all the pieces just sort of fell into place for something unpredictable and iconic to be born. And I love it. I love, love, love it.
I absolutely adore this movie. Almost every second of it is just completely entertaining. It's just such a blast. It's such a gem. I'm so happy it exists, and I will love it forever. It's one of the best Godzilla movies, one of the best King Kong movies, and that's all I have to say. Before we go, we have a couple pieces of feedback to read, as always. Both of these pieces are from Ethan Storing, the first of which is about our 29th episode, which was about Daimajin. Ethan says, "As always, I loved this episode. It's always a joy to hear G-Force's coverage, and I found myself nodding my head in agreement throughout the episode. I was a little disappointed to hear about the Arrow Daimajin collection. Unfortunately, I was late to that party and ended up hearing about it via your podcast 10 full days after I'd purchased an alternate trilogy. Oh well, I've double, triple, and even quadruple dipped on kaiju films before. No reason to stop now. This was my first time seeing Daimajin, and I genuinely loved it. Japanese films set roughly in this time period are a perennial favorite of mine, and this being a kaiju film as well made it an absolute slam dunk for me. From the stone-cold, pun intended, brutality of Majin, to the cliche yet enjoyable plight of villagers crushed under the heel of a brutal overlord, this movie offered so much in the way of entertainment. I also agree that the focus skewing from Kojenta and Tadafumi was jarring. Honestly, it was just part of the protagonist issue this movie has. It didn't seem to know who it wanted to lavish its attention on right up until Majin awakened. I'm glad to hear you guys tap into the terrifying nature of Majin's relentless pursuit. It's something I spent a lot of time thinking about while watching Majin's Rampage. As a lover of scary movies, It Follows is one of my favorites, because the notion of a never-ceasing, inexorable pursuit is one that is fundamentally terrifying to me. I would love to see a Daimajin movie where that angle is played up. This movie did a decent job building suspense. I can only imagine how much better it could do with that in the mix. hearing Andrew mention the cultural bias of the translator leading to a translation of capital G God rather than lowercase g God had me nodding my head every time God was mentioned throughout the movie. It pulled me out of it to wonder whether or not that interpretation mirrored the actual intent of the lines. Hopefully we'll get a new translation along with that spiffy Arrow box set coming out this summer. I'd also give my MVP to Chikari Hashimoto, who is able to convey so much menace and fury with his suit acting. It's worth noting that he started out as a professional baseball player until an injury ended his career. Rather than stew in the unfairness of it all, Chikara's next step was to join Dai Studios as an actor. He would go on to appear as Dr. A in Gamera vs. Virus, as well as Hiroshi Suzuki in Bruce Lee's Fist of Fury, in addition to playing Dai Majin in all three films. This has been Ethan, and I would love to see Majin face Anguirus. One covered in spikes, and one has a spike driven into his head. Clearly, this is a match made in heaven. This next one is in response to our 31st episode, which is about Rebirth of Mothra 2. In this comment, Ethan says, "Great episode of G-Force once again. Sometimes I feel that it's the less than stellar entries that really generate my favorite episodes. Something about hearing you all rage against a mediocre machine always ends up bringing a smile to my face. While I do enjoy this movie more than most of you, I think that's thanks in part to my not having expected the explicitly made-for-kids nature of the Rebirth of Mothra trilogy prior to watching it for the first time. Once I'd gotten over the tone and approach of the first one, which admittedly is still a better movie than this, I found I'd accept a lot more pandering to a child's mentality from the second. A lot of what you found frustrating, nonsensical, or broken about this movie was something I've always found endearing. James' thoughts around the 26-minute mark sums up a lot of why. Ultimately, it's kids being kids, and not expecting a lot out of this movie really helps in the way of enjoying it. I'm glad to hear Rebirth of Mothra 2's absolutely bonkers approach to grief and loss get called out. I'm hoping that Mull and Laura don't open up a therapeutic practice anytime soon. I personally love Rainbow Mothra in this movie. Rainbow Mothra is one of my favorite Mothra designs of all time. The patterning and colors are just incredible. Aqua Mothra, on the other hand, is one of the most buck wild designs for Mothra I've ever seen. I don't think I'd love it for a whole movie, but when it's just used for an OP monster destruction sequence, it stands as a crazy reveal that doesn't overstay its welcome. Although I do like this movie a whole lot, the lack of things I have to say about it or about your excellent thoughts on it really highlights for me what a middling entry it is. I don't dislike it, but I also don't find a lot of things to really gush about. Unlike, say, Gamera Super Monster, which I have so many issues with I could go off about it at length, Rebirth of Mothra 2 just isn't bad enough to inspire a lot of feeling one way or another. It's just aggressively good, but not great. Despite all that, and for whatever reason, it continues to appeal to me as a movie that I can pop in and enjoy whenever I'm not looking for a whole lot. This has been Ethan, and I would ask Gorgo to gift us with the miracle of a Rebirth of Anguirus trilogy." You know, ever since we did that episode, I've come around to Rebirth of Mothra even more, I think, and I think that's due to the editing process for that episode just making me really appreciate the score. And now I kind of want to revisit it, having enjoyed it more last time and having now come to really love the score for it, and just to see if it really comes together even more for me. But thank you, Ethan, as usual, for your feedback. I say this every time, but we just absolutely love reading your comments. So if anyone else wants to send us some feedback, you can find us on Twitter at GeForce Kaiju Pod, Instagram at GeForce Kaiju Pod. You can like us on Facebook at facebook.com/GeForceKaijuPod, or you can type into the search bar on Facebook, GeForce Kaiju Podcast. And you can also email us at GeForceKaijuPod@gmail.com. And if you'd want to give us a review on Apple Podcasts, that would be greatly appreciated. Thank you for listening, and remember to join us in 2 weeks when we finally say goodbye to Zone Fighter. So to close us out, in honor of Godzilla and King Kong being two iconic monsters that came together for the first time in this movie, and the fact that this was originally supposed to be King Kong versus Frankenstein, we are each going to say which other iconic movie monster. It can be a sized up version of a small monster if we want, that we would want to see Godzilla and or King Kong fight.
Hey, I have been Evan, and well, it seems rather obvious, but my choice would be to go with that that original concept that never was of King Kong versus Frankenstein. But I wouldn't want it to be the monster that was outlined in that script, alternately called Prometheus or the Ginkgo, which was a sort of hodgepodge of different animals. No, no. I would like to see King Kong fight specifically the Toho version of Frankenstein monster. It could be one of the Gargantuas, but there you start to get a little too visually similar to Kong for my tastes. I'd really like it to just be straight up giant humanoid Frankenstein monster. I think that would be, it would be really cool to watch them grapple. They're both fundamentally sympathetic characters, so no matter who wins, there's going to be some pain. You don't really want either of them to suffer. I just think it could be a really cool movie.
This is Brendan, and I would like to see Kong fight the entire population of Jurassic Park, because I've wanted to see it since I first saw King Kong 2005. And I want to see Godzilla fight this Dave Huff Marshmallow Man, because that would be the most delicious kaiju fight of all time.
I've been Nick, and I would really love to see Godzilla versus Dracula. Specifically, I would like to go back in time to the 70s and make this film, because to me, I think that's just when Godzilla would work the most in a movie like that. I think my idea would be, it would just, you know, you'd have Dracula in Tokyo or something, you know, being Dracula, biting people, killing people, turning other people into vampires. And maybe it seems like Godzilla's randomly attacking when he's really trying to find Dracula. And then later Dracula would grow into like a gigantic freakish vampire bat monster, and the two of them would fight in Tokyo at night under just a huge moon, and I just think it would be sick. And the score would just have like heavy organs. It would just be so cool. I want this so bad.
Since it's the 70s, can it please be Christopher Lee as Dracula and Christopher Lee made up as a giant bat monster?
I want to say, hang on, let me look him up. Actually, I could just ask you, who's the guy who played Agent Nunbara?
Oh, Shin Kishida. So it would be Japanese Dracula. Oh.
Yes, I would want it
totally,
to be him.
Okay, totally with you on that then. Yeah, Shin Kishida is the one man in the 70s who was as cool as Christopher Lee.
Yeah. I think there's some kind of animal outside making noises. Anyways, what the hell is that? Marion C. Cooper and Ernest B. Chodesack. I hope I pronounced that right. It sounds a lot like Chodesack. Well, I was gonna respond, but that. Brendan, it still says Brendan's offline for me.
Oh, I see Brendan is online.
I am here. It says Nick is offline.
And I just heard Brendan talk, even though it shows him as muted.
Wait, what? I just unmuted myself.
Brendan, I'm seeing you as muted, and yet I can hear you.
What the ding ding fiddly fuck? And it's intentional. I kind of love it. I don't know what that was. Holy shit.
Godzilla is like, so, sorry, just give me a second.
Well, we're waiting for Nick's, informed commentary as an actual musician. I have only this to say. Bum, 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 bum,
bum, bum, bum,
bum, bum, bum, bum, bum, bum, bum, bum, bum, bum, bum, bum, bum, bum, bum, bum, bum, bum, bum, bum, bum, bum, bum, bum, bum, bum, bum, bum, bum, bum, bum, bum, bum, bum, bum, bum, bum, bum, bum, bum, bum, bum, bum, bum, bum, bum, bum, bum, bum, bum, bum, bum, bum, bum, bum, bum, bum, bum, bum, bum, bum, bum, bum, bum, bum, bum, bum, bum, bum, bum, bum, bum, bum, bum, bum, bum, bum, bum, bum, bum, bum, bum, bum, bum, bum, bum, bum, bum, bum, bum, bum, bum, bum, bum, bum, bum, bum, bum, bum, bum, bum, bum, bum, bum, bum, bum, bum, bum, bum, bum, bum, bum, bum, bum, bum, bum, bum, bum, bum, bum, bum